World with Dr. Keith Suter.
Dr. Keith Suter from Global Directions, he joins me this afternoon. This all came about, today's little chat all came about as a question from an emailer, and it was from Doug, and Doug said, I have a question for you concerning President Putin attending the upcoming international summit. The world leaders, UN and human rights have cried that this Russian dictator and his army have committed war crimes in the Ukraine and that he must be held responsible. So how on earth can there be talk that this criminal may very well attend the summit? If world leaders and powers are to be genuine, what is stopping Putin from being arrested for his war crimes and crimes against humanity should he dare step out of this or out of his country? So that came from Doug. Dr. Keith Suter joins me this afternoon. Hello, Keith. How are you?
Yes, I'm very well. Thanks, Brent.
Keith, first question to you is, what is the definition of a war crime?
There are basically three types of war crimes. One is crime against the peace, which is a government leader ordering an invasion of another country, and that clearly is Putin's category. The second one is genocide, which is the mass extermination of a peoples, particularly, for example, the extermination of Jews in World War II. And then the vast bulk of war crimes are what are called war crimes proper, which are killing prisoners of war, raping people, etc. And there have been a number of individual instances of those types of alleged war crimes. Now, the caller was talking about Putin himself. Well, Putin is clearly not in Ukraine. He's not killing prisoners of war. So for him, the eligible crime would be crime against the peace. In other words, launching an attack on Ukraine. You've got to be a member of government to do this. And that's what he did on February 24. And for that reason, they would be interested in charging him. At the moment, he's not being charged. Karim Khan, who's a British lawyer and now chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, he is actually calling on countries to collect evidence. And indeed, Australia, well, originally in March under the Scott Morrison government, and now in the last couple of days, Penny Wong, the current foreign minister, have said, yes, we will be very happy to collect evidence of war crimes if we are assisting, for example, refugees to come to this country. It's called an evidence collection project. There's a similar one that's being run by non-governmental organizations relating to war crimes in Sri Lanka, and I've been involved with that campaign. So you collect all the statements from the witnesses, and that all goes eventually into some sort of war crimes trial. Now, we haven't had a war crimes trial yet in Sri Lanka, and the guy that we really ought to be going after has now fled the country, of course. But if you look back at former Yugoslavia, Slobodan Milosevic was wanted for alleged war crimes. And it's interesting, the international sanctions against Serbia were maintained even after the end of the war until Serbia gave up Milosevic, and he ended up going to The Hague. So what we could see here is that once the International Criminal Court have determined who is going to be accused of what, the international community, with their very punishing sanctions, one of the most extensive sanctions programs in world history, will simply say to the Russians, we're not easing up on the sanctions until you hand over these war criminals so that we can investigate them at The Hague. So it's not going to be done quickly, but the process takes a long time, but it is fairly thorough. And as I say, the Serbs, who wanted to try to improve their status in the human race, found it in their interest to hand Slobodan Milosevic over to the International Criminal Court.
Tell us about the 21-year-old Russian tank commander that admitted shooting a 62-year-old in the head a few days after the invasion. He ended up being sentenced to life in prison, was he not?
That's right, under Ukrainian legislation. So it's not an international criminal court. It's just that the Ukrainians were very smart in getting going, and they then put the guy on trial, and that clearly was a war crime, or under domestic law, could have been murder.
So, I mean, is it a fine line as to who orders the attack, who carries out the attack, who was in charge of carrying out the attack? I mean, obviously, we here in Australia are thinking we blame Putin for it all, because if it wasn't for Putin, we believe that this wouldn't be happening. Is that a fair comment or not?
No, I think it is a very fair comment. And, of course, you know, if you think back to the interviews we were doing before February 24, I was convinced, like most other commentators, that Putin wouldn't be stupid enough to invade.
Yes.
And yet he went ahead and did so. I think your comment is correct. This is very much Putin's war, and Putin will be held responsible for it. Now, it may well be in the interest of some of the Russians that they try to kill him, probably poison rather than shooting. It's interesting how often I'm getting all these echoes from World War II. All the various attempts to kill Hitler all failed.
Right.
He led a magical existence, even though there were a number of German, usually German officers, who were willing to die for the cause. And he was able to evade all of those attempted events. So that's one dimension. But that's why I say we need to have somebody just to shoot Putin or poison him. A second dimension to all of this is simply that the Germans, in order to be accepted as human beings back in the human race, agree to all the extensive denazification after World War II. And, of course, Germany now is a model country when it comes to human rights, civil liberties, etc. Hitler wouldn't recognize the country now. It's just so much concerned about human rights. Indeed, one of our problems with Germany is that they're not aggressive enough. We want them to be in there helping Ukraine, getting back to attacking Russia. They've done that in the past. They ought to be doing it again now. And the Germans are saying, no, we've been there, done that. You know, it's now a new Germany. We don't do those acts of violence, even in self-defense for the Ukrainians.
Keith, for people that don't follow the Russian-Ukraine situation on a daily basis, what's happening at the moment? I mean, where is Ukraine and Russia? I mean, who's winning this war?
Well, you'd have to say Ukraine's not losing.
Right.
It's not winning, but it's not losing.
Okay.
Ukraine is still putting up a very good fight, being armed by the West. And I think there is a determination that, given all the atrocities that have been committed and are now filmed on people's telephones, etc., given the anti-Russian feeling now, I think that people are quite happy to see the war go on to the last Russian. And, of course, it means for us in this country that we've got to be keeping an eye on everybody who's got a link with Russia. You just can't trust them. And that's how it's going to damage brand Russia, because I now don't speak to anybody who's associated with Russia. That's my way of drawing a line across the page, because you just don't know if you've still got some residual loyalty within that person for Russia. I've just come from a meeting, and people were just talking about the war being justified because they've got to get rid of all the Nazis in Ukraine. This is just the rhetoric of Adolf Hitler now being used by some Russians.
Can you see Putin being arrested for war crimes, charged with war crimes, or do you think it's a far reach?
I think it is a far reach, but I think it's more likely that Russians, realizing that in the long term, Putin's policy is damaging Russian economy, Russian standing in the world, and also seeing the death of a number of Russians. Remember, Russia lost half of its people in 1991 when the Soviet Empire was liberated. Countries like Ukraine and Poland were routinely almost lumped into Russian numbers if you were counting the number of people in the old Soviet Union, whereas now, of course, they're all separate. So Russia lost half of its population and a good deal of its own economy, because a lot of the output was coming in through places like Ukraine and Poland. And so Russia is a much weakened country, and although it's trying to improve relations with China, it'll be very much a junior partner to China this time around. If you go back to the time of the Chinese Revolution, the Soviet Union was very much the senior partner. Now it's going to be a junior partner, with the Chinese ordering them around. And, of course, ultimately, the Chinese will seek to get control over some of that Russian land. The Japanese, of course, they're also anxious to reclaim territories that they claimed that they lost in their conflicts with Tsarist Russia just over 100 years ago. And so Russia could end up just simply as a carcass, which we pecked at. Now, that's some years in the future.
Right.
But this is a huge gamble that Putin has taken, and he has failed. He has not secured control over most of Ukraine. He's got the eastern side, he's got the southern part, What he really could do with, I think, at the moment would be some sort of draw, let everything sort of slow down, because clearly he's not going to win. But then the Ukrainians can have difficulty evicting him. That's why, you know, we're now using the term of World War One and trench warfare with a stalemate on the Eastern Front, as we had a stalemate on the Western Front in World War One.
Goodness me. I've got to let you go as I have a news commitment. It's always wonderful to catch up with you. Thank you so much for putting what can be at times a difficult thing to understand in layman's terms that we do understand. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.